History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories around you that really need to be heard. We do not want them to go untold or unremembered. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that pursuit, we end up learning things that so often we really couldn't learn anywhere else. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It's not too often that you hear the same veteran's voice on more than one episode, but when it comes to 99-year-old George Coburn of Oceanside, California, it just wouldn't have worked to compress his story into one, especially since he had such an intense experience on the first day of the war for America, escaping the sinking battleship USS Oklahoma at Pearl Harbor, but then went on to serve the rest of the war on the cruiser USS Louisville, involved in almost every significant Pacific engagement and decorated with 13 battle stars. Today we're going to hear some of his memories from the Louisville, and we'll just roll seamlessly into that in a few. But to put it in context, especially for those of you who missed our last program, and you can pull that podcast up anytime at hometownheroesradio.com, of course, I thought we'd begin today by revisiting a few of the most powerful memories he shared about December 7th, 1941, on the Oklahoma, a ship which lost 429 men that day. George considers himself quite fortunate not to have become number 430.
The first torpedo hit, and the deck jumped, and it was a little bit more of a shock than when the main battery went off. But we weren't unaccustomed to explosions because we had gunnery practice fairly often. And anyway, the lights went out, and more torpedoes hit the ship. I've heard all kinds of numbers on how many there were, and I didn't try to count them, so I can't argue with them.
Is that the first time that it was really real to you, though, when you felt the impact of that first torpedo? Is that when you first knew that this was real and this was war?
Yeah, I would guess that was probably the beginning of realization that we got a problem here. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened was a source of oil got ruptured, and we got sprayed with fuel oil. The deck got covered with fuel oil, and because of that, and the ship was beginning to list, people couldn't stand up. It wound up that a pool of oil formed against the low side bulkhead, and men were slipping into that pool and just wallowing around in oil down there. I've thought many times, if they just thought about it, they'd have figured out how to get the heck out of there, but they didn't. As far as I know, they probably perished right there.
Because they drowned in the pool of oil?
Well, because they couldn't get out of the ship because they were stuck in this pool. And
again, this is in the dark as well. The lights are out. Can you see anything?
I could see a little because somebody showed up with a flashlight, and that was a big help. It helped the guys that were up on the ladder and trying to get the hatch open. It helped them a lot because they were using their fists and or anything they could find to try to hammer the dogs from their tight position. And well, they finally got it open, and everybody rushed for the ladder, and the darn thing broke. I don't know just what happened, but either some fitting came loose or the pin that secured the top of the ladder sheared, because a lot of men on a ladder, and the deck was over maybe 45 degrees by then, and oil on the deck didn't help the ladder stay in position either, so it just twisted. And somebody had the good sense to yell, "Everybody get the hell off the ladder or nobody will get out of here. It'll break." And so they, people complied with that. And then we went up one by one. And I don't know whether everybody got out or not. But we got up to the second deck and then on up to the main deck. And there was probably 10 of us together at that time. And I looked back, the normal exit from the ship would be out onto the quarter deck, and that was about maybe 100 feet away. There was a big group of men back there. It didn't appear to be moving. And besides, there was all kinds of gear and lockers and bunks and everything that was loose or jarred loose by the explosions had slid down against the bulkhead, and we would have had to crawl or make our way over that stuff in order to get back to the weather deck. I saw an open porthole. Shouldn't have been open. We were at general quarters. If it had been closed, I probably wouldn't even thought of trying to get out a porthole. But I decided that's for me. I went, crawled up across whatever was available to get a handhold on, and a few fellows followed me. Some of them went and started going back to the weather deck. And anyway, six of us got out of that porthole. And at the time, the side of the ship was easy to stand on because ship had rolled over far enough to where it wasn't level yet, but it was close to it. I didn't feel any fear or panic, but I think I was in shock.
Was there a moment for you where the magnitude of the whole situation sank in, where you could fathom how much had been destroyed and how devastating it was?
There actually was a moment like that. But it wasn't in proximity to the actual happening. It was decades later. In fact, it was fairly recent. I've thought about that morning many times, but this one time it seemed real again. And I thought, dang, there's something missing here. And later I wrote that the thing that was missing might be the emotional devastation that we suffered. I wrote, we lost our home, probably some good friends, all of our personal belongings, and our magnificent fleet was rapidly being turned into junk. I really felt the impact of that morning more strongly at that time than I did while I was experiencing it.
Well, and you know, I threw out that number, 429, and the only ship that lost more that morning was the Arizona, of course. But what about your family back here in San Diego? I'm sure they're hearing it on the radio that Pearl Harbor has been attacked. They know that's where you are. What did they experience?
You know, the Salvation Army, some ladies came by when I was at Westlock, and they gave us postcards and already stamped and pencils. And so I wrote on the postcard and put it in the mail. And I was lucky enough to get home in January. And I walked in the door and they thought I was a ghost. The postcard hadn't arrived, and it didn't arrive for several more weeks.
So your mother had presumed, because of the news reports, that you had died.
That's what they thought, yeah. They thought that I'd gone down with the ship like so many others did.
But then you walked in the door.
Yeah.
So what was the look on your mother's face?
astonishment and probably mixed with relief and et cetera. But I don't know. Primarily, it was astonishment.
For those of us who weren't alive then, we hear about Pearl Harbor, and we can go to the Arizona Memorial and see so many things and hear stories. But we didn't live through that time. Can you explain what the response or the resolve that that attack triggered, what you saw in America or in San Diego, in your family, in the Navy, after that, what it was like?
Well, I did see the buildup in the Navy, and it was quite impressive, really, that we had a lot of new ships come online, and we had plenty of people to man them, so our naval strength went up rapidly, even after the loss of the battleships, which up till then had been the frontline defenders. I might add that most of the battleships were repaired and did get to see frontline activity. The Oklahoma, of course, never did. The Oklahoma was sold for scrap and was being towed to the United States and had sunk at sea. And nobody ever explained how it got lost, but well, better than just sinking in the mud in the bottom of Pearl Harbor.
This is a life-altering moment, and one that I can see and we've heard can still trigger emotions for you, December 7th, 1941. But you had the whole rest of the war, and you weren't bored for the rest of the war. You were pretty busy. Tell me about the cruiser that you ended up on and what your duties were there.
Well, the cruiser was the USS Louisville, a heavy cruiser. We were equipped with a main battery of 9 8-inch guns at a 5-inch anti-aircraft battery and with 8 guns. And we also, I don't remember whether they had the 40 millimeters when I went aboard, but every time we came to the Navy Yard, we got more weapons installed on the ship. We used to say, they're making this darn ship top heavy. It's going to turn over sometime. And it, of course, for a battleship sailor, a cruiser was a different platform because it rocked around a whole lot more than the battleship did. And it took a little getting used to it. In fact, the first time at sea on the Louisville, they got a distress message and they made a turn in big heavy seas, a turn that put them running in the trough, you might say, between the two waves. And I was at topside and I looked up. A steep angle and I see green water way up there. And I thought, geez, I just got out of one that rolled over. Looks like I'm going to be submerged again. But the Louisville was a buoyant ship, and it just wasn't really perturbed at all. It went on.
Well, and that wasn't for lack of action, because just in recent months, well, in the last year, we've heard about a couple of cruisers that were sunk that have been found. They found the Indianapolis. They found the Helena. And the Louisville was never sunk, but there were some pretty close calls for you. What were some of those moments where it could have been your number?
The Louisville participated in almost all of the island campaigns in the Pacific. We missed one big battle.
Yeah, you missed the Battle of Midway, the one preserved so well aboard the aircraft carrier named for it, sitting right here in San Diego, one of the most impressive military museums you could ever visit. But your ship, the Louisville, missed Midway, that big turning point where, of course, the U.S. lost a carrier and a destroyer and over 300 men, but the Japanese suffered devastating losses, including 4 aircraft carriers that the Allies put out of commission.
The reason we missed that was we had been sent to the Aleutian Islands, and the Japanese had taken over Attu and Kiska. Intelligence said that there was a convoy on the way to replenish the Japanese garrisons. We were supposed to intercept it and destroy it. We never found it. Now, whether they got through or not, I have no idea. But the weather in the Aleutian Islands was absolutely atrocious. I mean, you could get up in the morning and have relative calm and a sea that was almost flat. And by nightfall, you might have winds of 100 miles an hour and mountainous seas that you couldn't see one ship from another because the waves were so high. And our masts were about 120 feet high.
Doesn't sound like anywhere any of us listening would like to be, does it? It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 99-year-old George Coburn. What were his duties aboard the cruiser USS Louisville? And what about his close calls with kamikazes? Check out some photos related to George and his story online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.